Good morning, and thank you for joining us today. It is August 12th. It's hard to believe the summer is almost coming to an end, but we appreciate you listening.
The heat's not coming to an end.
The heat's
I'll
not.
I'll tell you that.
So I guess summer is a loose term on that one.
Summer is till mid to what, the third week of September, right? So officially the season is, but the heat is going to be with us till it decides to leave.
Yeah, there's no doubt it's not done yet. It seems every year it starts a little later because, it seemed it started a little later this year.
You're right.
And now it's just falling further into the fall season, so to speak, and which means we're going to have 7:30, 8 o'clock, 9:30, 9 o'clock kickoffs for our University of Arizona football game since our first three games are at home in the month of September, August, and two in September. So
I think I read game one starts at 7 or 7:30.
Yeah, so we're going to have some, and it will still be pretty warm for the visiting teams that are coming in at that point.
That's true.
So it'll be great. Well, we appreciate everybody listening to us with the Morning Voice. The Morning Voice, 5 days a week, five different hosts, five different conversations going on. Yesterday, Lydia Ronda in a Rainmaker session on Mondays, and then Grant Kruger, Food for Thought on Wednesdays, Tom Moulton on Thursdays talking about all the attractions and upcoming events coming on, and then Ed Ackerley always closes out the week telling business success stories as well as the wonder of the University of Arizona. So we appreciate you listening in. Today, you have myself and Matt Neely behind the glass, keeping me on time and on target. And today is Civic Engagement Day. We call it the Engagement Hours. It's about trying to get you involved. We try to do that through highlighting stories of other organizations or individuals who are already engaged in this community. It could be in service to the community as an elected official, a first responder, serving in the military, or they're engaged through their jobs in the way of nonprofit work, leading different organizations throughout the region, but always trying to focus on helping you find how you can vote. And Matt, the most sacred way, or the way you can get engaged, sorry about that, the most sacred way is by our most important right we have as American citizens, and that's to vote. And
that's the biggie, isn't it?
It is the biggie. Since last week, Matt and I were talking before the show came on, so much has happened since last Tuesday. It's really hard to believe. We were here yesterday or last week encouraging everybody to get out to vote. And the primaries that you had, there were two Republican candidates, but they were running unopposed. They will be on the general. But in the three wards, Ward 3, 5, and 6, nearly a third of the Democratic registered voters in those districts showed up and voted. So a third actually is not a bad turnout for a primary.
You got a third? I thought it was like 15%.
15% is historic. And now what I'm trusting...
Wasn't 15% the turnout?
Is the news. The article today, this morning, okay, talking about May 19 references nearly a third of registered Democrats in Tucson voted in the three primary races, according to Monday's afternoon's updated results.
All right. Okay.
So the third's not bad. I mean, we've always talked 15% historically the voting rate a lot of times in these primaries, and that means nothing. But you've got to remember, it's a third of about 40% of the 47% of the voters.
Yeah.
So when you get down to the percentage of voters, you hit that 15%.
It's a fraction of a fraction because it's only three wards that voted because it's a primary, so it's ward only.
Oh yeah,
you got that, and of course the mayor had her two, well, basically all three of her preferred candidates, right? She had Kevin Dahl, who I'm sure she would have preferred to have him continue. And then you had Barajas in Ward 5, who I believe had the mayor's backing, and Miranda Schubert in Ward 6.
That's absolutely true. And I think what it shows once again in a lot of these cases, I mean, in Ward 3 with Sadie Shaw and Kevin Dahl was really close. Matter of fact, it's going to go to a recount.
It sure will.
The final ballot difference was 19. Ironically, when they stopped counting on Friday, which you had mentioned earlier, with 71 votes left to count, I mean, in both of our minds, we're going, come on, just push through for another hour, or hour and a half. You can get the results on Friday.
But they not only knocked off for the day, they said, they knocked off for the weekend. We'll finish it on Monday.
We'll see you on Monday. Now,
see you Monday.
But there was 19 votes on Friday, and it ended up 19 votes yesterday.
Yeah, that was kind of interesting. My first thought was, at some point, I don't know if it was the Sentinel or somebody released that they had identified 13 of the 71 remaining votes on Friday were for Ward 3. So my first thought was, well, if it's an odd number of votes, how could it still be 19, a difference of 19? It's impossible, right? Because one has to get more than the other.
Unless somebody filled out a ballot that was then when they looked at it.
Well, as it turns out.
And Matt, maybe they voted for you. Maybe they wrote in Matt Neely.
It was Ed Alexander. He was the write-in for Ward 3.
He was the write-in for Ward 3. Yeah.
1 year at least.
That's right.
So, but the deal was, you know, there weren't 13 votes counted. There were 16 votes, and it was 8 for each candidate. And so then you have a 19 votes separating them. And so Kevin Dahl won re-election by 19 votes. Okay.
Yeah. And the numbers on that one was 3296, so 3,296 votes to 3,277.
Mm.
And that is kind of a surprising outcome. I think a lot of people actually believe that Sadie Shaw ran a very good race. She obviously is on the TUSD school board.
Right. Yeah.
And what was interesting is one of the things amongst our team at SALC is we'll bring in ballot stuff when we get it in the mail. We'll try to bring it in to show, you know, just kind of see what kind of techniques and messages the different candidates are sending, just so we're aware of what they're thinking. And I'll tell you, Kevin Dahl did a lot of mailers in his district. We had somebody that was bringing all the mailers they received from Ward 3 in the Ward 3 district.
Interesting.
And that, to me, was an early sign that he was concerned. Because a lot of times, and we've talked about it with the current way that the elections are conducted in the city of Tucson, a lot of times the incumbents just need to show up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last time an incumbent was defeated, still, I think it goes all the way back to Nina Trasoff losing to Steve Kasachin.
Is that right? Yeah, it could well be.
Because I don't recall any upsets in Ward 1 ever. I don't recall any upsets of the incumbents once they get in there. So it's, I mean, we've obviously, I know you and I have talked about it, and SALC as an organization and myself personally believe that the current, having the general election be throughout the city is not representative form of government, because you're letting people outside the ward being represented select who's going to represent you.
Right.
You know, the argument is, well, we narrow it to the top two. No, you narrow it to the top Democrat and the top Republican. You don't narrow it to the top two.
Mm-hmm.
If it was an open primary, like the other 28 charter cities in the state of Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and I was talking with one of the current members of the council yesterday and pointing that out, and I said, it's amazing that they don't realize that sometimes. They forget it. But right. 29 charter cities in Arizona, 20 of them have open primaries, and if you use wards or districts, the general is also by tight. Ward or district.
Yeah,
it just seems fair.
Yeah.
But other than that, I'd say the election was pretty flawless. What do you think?
Well, you know, when you have a county recorder that sends the wrong ballots to dozens upon dozens of, I think ultimately it ended up being about 350. I don't remember the exact number. They'd said it originally it could be up to 1,300.
1,300, yeah, just under.
But I 1, think it was 350, 360, something like that. But I'm sorry, Ted, if you send out 368 of the wrong ballots to homes, and then you have an election like this in Ward 3 where 19 votes separated the two, how can you say that didn't have some bearing? I mean, you know, Ward 6, Schubert steamrolled her opponent, Leighton Rockefeller, and, you know, whatever. That is what it is. But it's hard to make that. Abe Hamadeh, he has the same argument where any sort of, and a lot of things were brought up in the state election when he ran for AG, a lot of ballot box issues and printer issues. Well, you know, if the margin of victory is, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of votes, it's hard to make the case.
Absolutely.
So for him, it was out of 4 or 5 million votes cast, it was 185. And so here, taking it right down to the local level, again, you know, elections, this is the big one, Ted. This is the big one. This is the cornerstone that all of it is built over, that they're fair, that they're fairly administered, that they're correctly and competently administered. And when you have a difference of 19 votes, and then you have you inject something like, well, how many of those 360 some odd votes were in Ward 3 that went to the wrong person? And how many, they said that they reached out to everybody, but, you know, when it's 19 votes, a very small inflection can cause that difference.
And reaching out doesn't necessarily mean contact.
Right.
It just means you did something to try to correct the wrong. Obviously, the wrong should never happen. I mean, there's only so many things you do. And I understand with the CD7 election, there was another election, the ward mm-hmm. election. So that may have changed on how people could change ballots, but when they could change their parties. But it's still, you've got one job to do, and that's to administer the election correctly. Now, when we talk about how the collection areas work, when we talk about the same day voting, there's a lot of cogs in there that can go wrong. But getting the ballots to the right people for the right parties seems like it should be pretty straightforward. And to your point, as soon as a race is close, like this one was in Ward 3, I mean, 19 votes, they're recounting, it just puts doubt in the system, no matter how it is. And that's something that we can't afford when the bedrock, we've got, you know, redrawing districts is a whole nother story.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, you know, everybody likes to throw around the word gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And I think in the state of Arizona, we've got a really good system because it is independent. It's not the elected officials that draw the lines. So many states in the U.S. still the elected officials draw the lines. But the fact is, you are gerrymandering. You're always gerrymandering. What we're trying to do is you're trying to gerrymander it in a way that it's fair. And I think that's something we've seen it work well in Arizona, and we've seen it work questionably in Arizona. But at least it's being done by independent citizens, as far as independent when you were selected by elected officials, but independent citizens and not the people whose livelihood depends on the outcome of the election.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but you know, getting back to this, I don't see how you can't. Nobody can say that that the Ward 3 primary wasn't somehow impacted by this ballot.
Absolutely.
Right? And that's my thing. You know, that's why these things are important. That's why these things matter. And I don't think we're going to hear anything. I'll tell you another thing. On the calendars, I think I brought it up on this, or maybe with Grant, but the recorder had two versions of the calendar. And I think I'll have to look it up, but I think on the primary election, there were a couple of dates wrong with the date you could pop it into the mail, right? The deadline. Again, how many ballots didn't make it in time because of that? Okay. And so I hate to use the phrase, you had one job, but you had one job. And so it's really important. This stuff is really important. And it's the cornerstone. It's the cornerstone. It's the cornerstone of the whole shooting match.
It really is. If we consider our most sacred, and I say it all the time, our most sacred right and responsibility is that to vote, you have to ensure there's 100% confidence that your vote will be counted correctly and will matter.
And then there's another issue with this, and maybe we'll get to it after the break, but as far as taking, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, so it's almost 4 days to count the last 1,700 ballots, and that's a process issue. I'm not blaming the people counting it. They didn't do anything wrong, but it's a process issue that maybe should be fixed.
And we'll talk a little bit back when we get back on the other side of the break, Matt. Hope you stay with us for the entire show today at 7:30, the bottom of the hour. We're going to have Austin Wright, the Chief Communication Officer of Tucson Airport Authority, and tell us about the expanding service out there, as well as their recent economic impact. And then at the top of the hour, 8 o'clock, we'll be joined by David Godleski with the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association to talk about most anything that's going on in our region, both regards to housing, but also to economic development and growth. So please stay with us. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be right back. Good morning and welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass, picking out the music to take us in and out of the show. Well, Matt, we were talking about the Tucson election. I mean, this morning we started saying there were so many things that happened, but I don't want to drop the elections yet. But we've got, you know, city council meeting. We're going to have some opportunities at the end of the show as well to talk, but I want to make sure we get to some of those. But one of our listeners sent in the latest printout from the city of Tucson, the primary elections. Okay, one of our listeners, Kathleen Wynn, who hosts Wynn Tucson, so stay with her in the 9 to 11 o'clock hour immediately following the Morning Voice. But she pointed out, the total voter turnout for all the parties, so that's Libertarian, Republican, as well as Democrat, was 17%. It was 32% of the registered Republicans in those three wards voted.
Okay.
But only 17% of the total registered voters from those three wards.
That's amazing amount of leverage to inflect the city. Again, that election, the last week's election, I mean, Mayor Romero sewed up a really solid majority because she got two very close, to her ideologically, to the point that where she endorsed them and supported them.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what you saw again is the importance of a ground game. There was so
the
much
machine.
Going on. If you take a look at CD7, now Congresswoman-elect Grijalva's race, take that back. There's still a general. There is a general, so I apologize.
Oh.
Apologize to Mr. Boudier, to Mr. Boudieras. I may have to now reach out and get him some on the radio because
that's a Freudian slip.
But all indications are it's a very tough district for the Republicans to win. I think it's
your point. Yes.
To what we talk about, safe districts in our state, that is a relatively safe one for the Democratic candidate. But during that campaign, both Selena Barajas, who won in Ward 5, and Miranda Schubert, who won in Ward 6, were present at a lot of those local rallies for Adelita Grijalva, because they were part of that team, had that support, and were walking doors. So it was double duty. You were walking doors both for the CD7 candidate and for the Ward 5 and Ward 6 candidates, and it works.
Yeah.
In something that has fairly narrow margins and fairly small turnouts. I mean, we're talking 7,000 people is all that voted in Ward 3, for example, and it ended up being 19 votes difference.
Right.
How do you touching base and actually talking to people, especially when it's vote by mail, and if they haven't, you could go, hey, let go get your ballot, turn it in right now, and somebody might do that. So the turnouts were always in danger. Now, something you mentioned, or not, the turnouts are always a concern. And again, I thought actually 32% of the folks that are registered actually vote now, because normally we get about a 60 to 70% turnout in the general. So it's about half.
Right.
Sometimes we complain that it's even lower in the primaries because people think, oh, I'll just wait to vote to the general. Well, in these ward races, for Selena Barajas, she is now elected. There is
Correct.
No Republican. Right. Candidate in Ward 5. So she will be the city.
She didn't have to stand member. The citywide litmus test.
Correct.
Right.
And it's interesting enough for Miranda Schubert, she probably wishes it was by ward because she would definitely beat because of just the percentage of voters, Jay Tolkoff in Ward 6. However, now here's a case where he's a candidate that will be helped by the at-large general in that race, mm-hmm. much like Steve Kasachek was when he was a Republican and beat Nina Trasoff.
Sure.
But one of the things you brought up before we went to the break was the delay in getting results in Arizona.
Right.
And 7 days compared to what last election cycle was actually pretty good.
Right.
But the question is why?
Election is Tuesday. Polls close at 8:00. The lion's share of the ballots had been received by the city in the mail. So 8:01, you can start feeding those things, or 7:01, or whenever they start counting, you feed those things through the machine. They've been verified and they're ready to go. And that's the key that I get back to. They've been verified. There's something wrong with the way the rules are set up that you can drop off a ballot on election day. And then they say, well, we need 3 days to verify we got the stack of them. We got to verify the signatures on them. You have what I believe is the right solution to this. Go ahead. And
there is an easy fix. And it's the same one we've stated time and time again for the statewide elections. Well, and our statewide elections make Arizona look ridiculous. I mean, the presidential elections where they're too close to call, we're going into day 7, day 9,
right.
day 10. I mean, it just makes us look silly. And everybody in the state, you read all the letters to the editor. Why can't we do it? If Florida can have it 2 hours after the election, why does it take us 10 days? The reason is because of the signature verification.
Right.
And the simple fix, which you alluded to, is when you show up to vote in person,
mm-hmm.
you're required to show an ID.
Right.
So if you're dropping off a ballot in person, why shouldn't you be required to show an ID?
If it is inside of that date where they can be received in the mail.
Correct.
If it is inside of that, you better show your ID to do that. Sorry. It's just, that's because here's the deal, Ted. You said it makes us look silly. Well, if you're sitting there with a 19 vote lead and there's 71 votes left to count and you say, you know what? We're not going to come in tomorrow. We're not going to stay a couple hours and do them or come in tomorrow and do them. We're going to do them on Monday. I'm not, and I want to be very clear. I am not saying that there was anything afoot, but it makes people think with something that close that there is something afoot. It gives people a perception that, well, we got to finesse this thing through. I'm not, again, not accusing anybody of doing that, but it makes people nervous, especially when you have such a small population of votes left to count.
It plants that seed of doubt.
Sure.
It gives anybody who wants to be a conspiracy theorist plenty of room, plenty of room to make the case.
Right.
So I'm a strong proponent that whether it's state, there's a deadline where you have to mail it in by for it to be received and counted. It has to be received and that so they can do the verification. And if you're going to take your choice to drop it off there, you have to show your ID.
I'm with you, Ted.
Have to show it.
If you want the convenience of dropping it in the mail and letting somebody else verify your signature later, then meet the deadline. I'm with you, Ted.
Yep.
You know, either meet the deadline, have
there
some personal
is.
Responsibility.
Let's fix
or
it.
Bring your driver's license or whatever ID that they require to the polls and do it right then and there. I mean, 1,700 votes and it was like 7-8 o'clock Friday night when they announced what the results were.
Yep. There you go. All right, you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We'll be back with Austin Wright from the Tucson Airport Authority. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass. Matt, thanks for that opening segment, or two, I should say two segments.
Good stuff.
That was good conversation, a lot going on, and I think we're at the end of the show today. We're going to get a little bit more time to talk. Maybe we'll talk about last week's city council meeting.
All right.
A lot going on there.
Yeah, there was a lot.
So appreciate everybody joining us this morning. It's 7:34 and traffic looks pretty good today. So that's a good day for driving through the region. It's a lot of good information, but we've got a asset in our community that I think a lot of people don't recognize the role it plays, and they misunderstand not only the economic impact, but the convenience and the accessibility that it provides us. So this morning I'm being joined by Austin Wright. He's the Chief Communications Officer for the Tucson Airport Authority. So Austin, thank you for calling in. I appreciate having you on the line.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Well, I want to thank Tucson Airport Authority for supporting the engagement hour on the Morning Voice. I appreciate all the support that both you and Danette Bealey, the CEO, have provided me and with this show, but more importantly, through all my years as a member of the Air National Guard, which is out on the base. I want to jump right in. I was going to do it the other way around. I think let's jump right into the economic and fiscal impact analysis that was just released. It's a great story for the influence that TIA, Tucson International Airport, and Port has on our region. So can you tell us a little bit about first the relationship between TIA and TAA, and I'd love you to throw in how you came to work at TAA as well.
Yeah, so Tucson International Airport is operated by the Tucson Airport Authority. Tucson Airport Authority is obviously TAA, and they also operate Ryan Airfield to the west of TUS. So we just did a new economic impact study. It's an annual economic impact study, and it's $10.9 billion, which is huge for us. It's huge for the region. The last time we did this was 2019, and we were at $8.4 billion. So in about 5 years, we've done a lot of growing at the airport, and we're doing a huge $400 million runway program right now, the Airfield Safety Enhancement Program, creating a second full-size parallel runway. So there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening at the airport, but we're even more proud of the fact that the airport creates some 42,000 jobs for the region that pays almost $3 billion in wages.
I mean, that's a huge number. Obviously, I shouldn't say obviously. So are the members of the Arizona Air National Guard that operate the 162nd Wing, are they included in those jobs and that creation? Because obviously without the airport and without the support of TAA, that organization couldn't exist.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's a big part of our daily operations. I mean, they are just launching fighter jets all day, every day. And we're lucky enough from our offices that we get to watch it all day. So we tell people when they come to visit us at the airport, we get to see an air show every single day. And they're great partners. And we love sharing the airport with them.
I'd be lying if I didn't tell you when I come and fly, I go and fly out of TIA, I'd like to take those early morning flights. It's because looking out the windows and seeing the planes take off, I get not only a little jealous, but it really is good to see.
Right around 8:30.
Yep. Right, 8:30 is one of the launching things. So,
yep.
So you mentioned the runway that's being built out there and will provide the airport more opportunities. Can you describe a little bit more about the need from both the safety standpoint as well as an operational standpoint and the importance of that runway?
Yeah, I mean, the reality is we're an old airport. I mean, you know that. We've been there for the Airport Authority just celebrated 75 years about 2 years ago. So it was time to update. Obviously, safety standards update through the FAA pretty regularly. And our airport was always safe, but we had to make some modernizing adjustments to have proper spacing between the two runways, for instance. There's always been a second runway, but it was a small general aviation runway. And we've demolished that, and we're creating a second full-size parallel runway, which means we'll have added redundancies. So, for instance, you could have the fighter jets operating on one runway and commercial aviation operating on the other simultaneously. Because sometimes we get, you know, a string of 7 or 10 fighter jets taking off, and then we have airliners sitting, you know, on the taxiway waiting for 10 or 15 minutes to take off. This new runway lets us run both at the same time without really any impact to operations. It was really just a spacing issue. We created more space between the two runways.
Well, I know the National Guard's looking forward to it, but what kind of impact do you think it will have on our opportunity to attract more either carriers or more flights to Tucson?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in the coming year, our goal, we're on the fiscal year, so our new fiscal year will start October 1st. And our goal is to create a new campaign in the region called Fly TUS First. So we want to really collaborate with local businesses to get a commitment from businesses to support our local airport. The only way we will grow air service is when we have the data that shows the airlines there is demand out of Tucson, not out of Phoenix, out of Tucson for a flight. So we're going to try to leverage the business community to really stand behind our airport and get the data we need to get flights like New York City, Boston, Washington Dulles, just outside of D.C., flights to Orlando, flights into Mexico. There's a lot of real opportunity for growth. We just need people to use the airport today and not wait until we have those nonstop flights, because we won't get them unless you fly today.
Oh, that's absolutely true. And one thing that I've learned from your boss, Danette Bewley, is always search TUS first. There are a lot of people, especially on the Northwest side, that may say, I can get a direct flight out of Phoenix. But if you don't even search TUS, then the airlines don't understand that there are people out there looking for direct flights out of TUS.
There's also a misconception, too, that there's this massive price difference between flights out of Tucson and flights out of Phoenix. The average difference in fare between the two, it's a $40 fare premium out of Tucson. Well, we can save you that $40 in parking in just a couple of days. So even if you do have to spend $40 more to fly out, you'll save it in so many ways, your time, the parking, the convenience. I mean, the list goes on and on, but yes, check TUS first. We have billboards throughout the city now that say that because so many people just automatically have their mind programmed to go to Phoenix because it's a bigger airport, of course. It's a hub airport for two airlines, but we can get you to almost 500 destinations around the world with a single stop. And for a small hub airport, that's pretty impressive.
Well, and on top of it, you've been attracting some new carriers or carriers that are coming back that may have turned away from the Tucson airport recently. Do you have any that you'd like to highlight on that front?
Yeah, we're out hitting the road all the time. We're trying to build relationships with these airlines and show the value in flying out of Tucson. It's a great market for the airlines. We just had Frontier Airlines come back into our market March of this year. And since they entered with just one daily flight to Denver. They're now up to three nonstop destinations, which are Denver, Las Vegas, and now they just announced starting in October, Dallas, Fort Worth, DFW. So their growth is rapid at this point. The community has really rallied behind Frontier. They've had great load factors, great performance. They are a new airline. They have really, and Frontier's been around forever, but it's a different experience. They have new Airbus A321neos flying into Tucson. They're really focused on reliability, that what you book, you're going to get. And it's no frills. And I think people like that. You know, if you don't need to travel with three suitcases, you're going to save a lot of money on Frontier. So it's an ultra low fare product.
And that does open the market up to some folks who may not travel or may be worried about that $40, you know, price differential. I mean, your point about the parking is spot on. There's no doubt about it. If you're going for more than a quick weekend, the parking difference will make up the difference in that $40. But for a lot of families, I think those who travel more regularly think, oh, flying's not a big deal. But for a lot of families, one of the big moments of their trips, their summer trips, are these flights. And I think Tucson's airport, with its small nature, or that it's just not a crowded, bustling airport, lets those families have a greater experience for their vacation as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, too. If you look at the data trends right now in air service, domestic travel is actually down. But consumer spending is at an all-time high because people are spending a little bit more money for a bit more of a premium experience. And we take a lot of pride in our airport being a bit more of a premium experience than, you know, say Phoenix, where you're dealing with tons of crowds and faraway parking. We take a lot of pride in our airport and the culture and the spirit of our airport. We're friendly. We're easy to use. We want to serve our entire community. And Frontier has allowed us to do that, because now we have that ultra low fare option as well. So everyone in Southern Arizona can find what they need at the Tucson International Airport.
Well, Alaska's also expanded some of their service as well. And I'll tell you, Alaska Airlines is one that I do like flying up. I've got family up in the North Seattle area, and the service in and out of Payne, but also to SeaTac, is great for Atlanta. But I believe they're going to start having more flights to Portland.
Yeah, Alaska is a great brand. They continue to invest in Tucson by adding new flights, trying new things. Obviously, they're going through a merger right now with Hawaiian Airlines, which is a bit of a different dynamic for us. And they're focusing more on hub flying versus point-to-point flying. So we're going to see more daily flights to Portland starting in October. We'll have two a day. Portland has a lot of passenger demand out of Tucson. We get a lot of people coming here for vacation from Portland. A lot of students go to the University of Arizona from the Portland region. So we're really happy to see that they're upping that to two times a day. And we hope that as they kind of build this new reimagined airline in partnership with Hawaiian, that they continue to try new things and give more frequency flights to Tucson.
So does that mean I can quote you here as saying soon we will have a direct flight from Tucson to Honolulu?
You know, I sure hope so. I promise you, we pitch that every time we meet with them. We don't think it'll happen on the daily basis, but we really do have the data that would support a less than daily flight on an Airbus A321 to Hawaii, to Honolulu specifically. So it's actually on our dartboard that we're throwing darts at, seeing if something will stick. We want it as bad as I think the rest of this community does.
Well, I think Matt was about ready to start booking his first Hawaiian trip out of Tucson.
The good news is
I'm ready too.
The good news is it's Hawaii. Bad news is it's a CRJ 900. But you know,
Luckily, I think they're going to need something a little bigger to get you there. So
it will be
good.
CRJ 9 Omega.
that would be a real bummer trip if you got on a CRJ 900 and said we're going to see you in Honolulu. Right. Not quite sure how the final leg of that portion of that flight would go.
Wouldn't be good.
No, it would not. All right, Austin, we're going to cut to a break right now. But when I get back, what I'd like to talk to you about is how you've mentioned the decrease in passenger travel overall. And how I'd like to hear a little bit of how Tucson International Airport and TAA's support's been coming through that time. So look forward to talking to you when we get back. Everybody, you're listening at 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station. Stay with us to learn more about what's going on at the airport. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. I guess, Matt, I spoke a little too soon on the traffic looking pretty good out there today. We've had a couple accidents, and the freeways are starting to show some traffic.
Yeah, I think it's just a symptom of getting back to school. It's the board's been pretty empty for the last couple of weeks, and I think, you know, kids are getting back to school. And
That's true. There's been a lot of green. So if you're out there on these roads listening to us during your drive time hour, hey, be patient. Safe is how you want to get where you're going. Late is better than not at all. So take the time and keep listening to The Morning Voice.
That's right.
We'd love having you as a listener.
Yeah.
So with me right now is Austin Wright, the Chief Communications Officer for Tucson Airport Authority. I want to reemphasize, we didn't talk a lot about it, Austin, but I want to emphasize that economic impact. I kind of didn't state that loud enough. $10.9 billion in economic activity, 42,000 jobs that rely on the Tucson Airport and the Tucson Airport Authority, nearly $3 billion, $3 billion in wages in this community. That is significant for the economic activity in this community. Not only is TA making a difference, but it's also, you're a good employer, Raytheon, Air National Guard, those are all solid places where people could find good work. So I just want to, again, compliment you on the fact that in 5 years, you've grown almost, you know, 25% and maybe just a little under that in economic input to the region. So thank you for what you do.
Yeah, thank you. It's really an impressive number. And a lot of people actually don't realize, Ted, that we have 8,000 acres. We are a huge airport, massive. One of the top 10 landmass airports in the United States, which is why we're able to do so many great business things and economic development. We just built a new hangar for SkyWest Airlines on the airfield, and they get a lot of really amazing employees from Pima Community College on the other side of the airfield. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening that isn't always viewable to the public when they see just our small terminal. There's 8,000 acres of business activity happening all over the Tucson International Airport.
So I'd like to talk about how successful the airport is being. We've talked about the new flights. We've talked about Frontier coming back. As a community, we greatly appreciate to see that because of the ease and convenience of traveling out of TIA. And again, TUS should always be your first look for travel. Last year, there was a pretty significant increase in travelers, a large part fueled by migrant travelers that were flying around the country on the federal dollars. How are we doing in 25 compared to what was a very busy last season for passenger travel out of Tucson?
Yeah, so last year we finished at about 3.9 million passengers, which was huge for us. That was our busiest year since 2008, which was really the peak of Tucson International Airport. This year, we're projected to pass that at about 4.1 million passengers, and that's with zero migrant travelers. So we are really, really proud that we got all of this added capacity. In fact, last year we had about 14% more seats than we had the year before because of the influx of migrant travelers. And we aren't losing those seats because the community is rallying behind the airport and using them. So we just got July numbers through the TSA, and we finished 5% higher this year than we did last year for passenger numbers, which with zero migrant travelers, that's amazing. The fact that we're filling these seats and retaining capacity shows that the message is getting out to the community. People are using our airport. They understand the message. They appreciate the convenience. And we are here to continue to serve. And we're doing everything we can to grow and get more flights and really meet the needs of this community. And the fact that they're flying what we have will help us do that.
Well, and one of the points that I know we've talked about this before is the airlines want to fill their planes. They look at the capacity and the percentage of seats. You know, we always talk about butts in the seats make a difference. It's the difference of the butts in the seats. And the fact of the matter is, if we don't continue to fill them, we're going to lose them.
100%. Yeah, that's how the game works. The airlines are here to make money. As bold as that sounds, they're a business. And they put their planes where they will have the most seats full, making the most revenue. And we're in a great position because we outperform our West Coast peers in terms of revenue performance, but it's not so extreme that it pushes the consumer away. We talked earlier about the $40 fare difference between Phoenix. $40 is enough for the airlines to make a lot of money in Tucson without pushing people from using the airport. So it's a good problem to have. Flights are definitely full.
Like you said, it's a great problem to have, and it's still a convenient airport. It's simple. You can get there, get through security, grab a beverage or a meal before you get on your plane, and it is a true travel experience. So, Austin, thank you for joining us today. I appreciate what you do out at Tucson Airport Authority, and I appreciate all that the authority does for our region.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. We'll have you back soon. That's the Austin Wright, right, the Chief Communications Officer for Tucson Airport Authority. And you are listening to 1030 The Voice, your trusted local news and talk station.
Good morning, Ted.
Oh, good.
Welcome back.
So as with all good things, first off, there was a moment there on the dropping sales at the cannabis stores and the movement. I think you're going to see that eventually coming.
But they're buying more and paying less. So competition enters the cannabis industry.
It is a business. And in all businesses, the more competition there is, the more demand or price pressure is going to be out there.
For instance, if we had a second four-year university in Tucson, it might have forced some competition for an example. Yes.
Yes, for an example. There's no doubt about that one. Well, I'm honored to welcome, welcome back to the Morning Voice. Sorry, we immediately got into that transition. What was occurring, if you're watching us on our Facebook or YouTube live stream, you may have seen my next guest, David Godleski, come in, go out. I guess that traffic finally is coming back. The back-to-school traffic is there. Shortly, we'll get some more of the snowbirds coming back after we get out of these temperatures that we're seeing again this weekend. You got a little caught up in it, but your timing was actually perfect, David. You walked in right at the perfect time. So I'm honored to have David Godleski with the President and CEO of the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association joining me this hour.
Morning, Ted. Happy to be here. A little slower than I would have liked, but by the skin of my teeth, right? Is that what they say?
That is what they're saying. So David and I and Matt are going to talk about all things Tucson today, but I want to start off with giving you an opportunity, your primary role and job as running one of the most influential and largest trade organizations in this region is to advocate and both advocate on behalf of your members.
That's right.
Home builders.
Yep.
And so how is the housing market looking right now in Southern Arizona?
Well, you know, I'm trying to be optimistic, but it's a little rough out there, especially when you look at year-over-year comparisons. Things aren't the greatest right now. We've seen kind of a slow but steady decline in buyer interest. The traffic through those new home communities is not nearly as strong as it's been in the past few years. And so I would describe it as, I guess, a subtle pullback in the market right now. You know, builders are being very cautious and careful about how they proceed. You know, in those kind of that 2020, 21, 22, they were doing everything that they could to combat the supply chain challenges, the labor issues, other COVID-related things. At that point in time, you know, it was taking 9, 10, 12 months to build a house. That time frame has come down. But in order to be able to keep up with the demand that was coming through the door, they were building a lot of spec homes to be ready for that buyer to have that kind of move-in ready home when they came in. And right now, it's shifting back, and they're wanting to make sure that there's not a lot of overhang, a lot of unbuilt inventory. So they're just being slower in terms of the amount of permitting, just to put some numbers to that. So for example, I should have July numbers here today potentially, but right now going off of June numbers, in 2024, June, we did 434 single family permits. In June of 2025, 301. So that's a decline of about 30%. And so this year, year were off about 35% in total of permits. That's kind of the measurement that we use to gauge the health of the market. So I do think, you know, right now it's a great time if you're a home buyer. You know, go in. They're offering lots of incentives, lots of deals, buying down mortgage interest rates. But the numbers just aren't there, and the market is showing some softening.
And that's always a challenge, but, you know, being a small airline or a small aircraft pilot, you know, I'll fly over, and there are developments. They are growing. I mean, they finally caught up, and now we're facing this downturn. How bad does that influence the builders or hurt the builders, really? Because if they've got homes that are built that aren't moving, obviously that's money that's going unused to go towards the next project. And how does that impact affordable housing in this region as well?
Well, I think, you know, we have seen a lot of growth, and there was kind of these pent-up households, and you always talk about household formation. So, you know, the past 4 or 5 years have been great, right? We've been building new communities, helping people achieve that dream of home ownership. I do think, you know, looking long term, Tucson is still a place that the builders want to be invested, that they see the potential for. And so right now, while we may be experiencing some softening, I do think long term that the outlook is good. But when it comes to affordability, you know, that's still where the challenge is. You know, you've just seen prices not really come down tremendously. There has been some decline, a few percentage points in terms of the median new home price, but you're still pushing. I think in June it was $388,000 was the median new home price, and the other reality is that these are homes that are being built in communities that were developed in that 2021, 22, 23 timeline, and so those builders were buying land at a premium at that point in time. There's still so that large land cost or land basis is you can't do anything with that, right? And materials, like I said, are still elevated. The word of the day in terms of kind of the industry parlance, or what I've been hearing, is haircut, right? So everybody's asking, you know, the builders are asking the trades to take a haircut, land sellers to take a haircut, everybody trying to do what they can just to maybe moderate the prices to keep the homes affordable.
And when you say haircut, you talk about what those trade workers and the support elements in the building a home actually taking less.
That's
so the
right.
Haircut isn't necessarily less being put into the house, although that can be a factor as well. Yeah. It's really about that profit margin or the subs as well as the builders themselves to go down.
Yeah, it is, you know, and I guess, you know, you know, I don't think I'm divulging, you know, kind of trade or industry secrets here, but that's been a big part of the story the past, you know, 6-12 months, if not longer. The builder's margin has just been one of the first things where you've seen, you know, a quote haircut or reduction just to be able to keep the prices at a price point that the buyers in our market can afford. And so we've just seen a steady increase in materials and labor and all of those things. And so now everybody is just trying to, you know, tighten their belts is probably a better way to say it.
Well, let's stay on the affordability piece for a little bit. You talked about a lot of the builders now are offering incentives.
Yes.
And one of the things that you hear all the time is with the current interest rates, which historically over decades is not that high, but compared to what they've been in the recent decade, people look at it high when you talk to some folks and they've got interest rates locked in at 3%. So realistically in this market, how much can a builder afford to help somebody interested in buying a house buy down their rates?
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, Ted, I must have been reading your mind. So I was looking at some numbers, and of course there are a lot of different factors that kind of go into the final price of a, you know, mortgage payment. But in 2020, the median new home price was about $310,000. And so at a 3% mortgage interest rate, 20% down, you were paying just under $1,300 a month. So going back to what I said today, the median new home price is $390,000. You're, you know, a 6.7 or so mortgage interest, you're paying, almost $2,400 a month. right? So that's over $1,000 a month from the you're paying from the median new home in 2020 compared to the median new home in 2025.
Wow, I mean that's yeah. that's
it's huge.
Huge. I mean you're yeah. saying it's almost requires double the household income to be able to afford the house based on the I think what the 33% or the 30% the recommended amount that of your income that should go towards your home, either rent or house payment. That makes it tough on the community.
It really does. And that's where the builders have been become, you know, the one thing that I've learned over my time at Saba, they're resilient, right? They are in the business of building, selling and closing homes. And so they're going to try and do whatever they can through, offering incentives, like I mentioned, or trying to buy down the rates. And so they have been working and been very aggressive to mitigate that increase. And so, they're able to buy down, whether it's just a couple of years. Some of them, I think, are getting creative and being able to offer that lower rate over a longer period of time. But yeah, I mean, those are real dollars that we're talking about in that monthly price increase. And so they're just trying to figure out whatever ways that they can do to reduce that monthly burden and keep things going and helping those home buyers get into that new home.
$383,000 is high, obviously, for what we would say Pima County as a whole, based on where our
right.
median income mm-hmm. sits. What are the things that are the barriers to the home builders that prevents them from either being incentivized or just a good, solid business decision to build more affordable housing, which may open up to more homes and families? Because that's how we create wealth in this country, is through home ownership.
It still is. I believe that strongly. We look at it and, it always starts with the land. You can't move the land. The land is where the land is. And I've heard estimates of upwards of, 20,000 single family home lots or future locations for homes to be built are kind of locked away because of the infrastructure challenges that we have being able to, whether it's roads, whether it's drainage, whether it's water, whether it's sewer, probably in many cases, all the above. Is it's important to make sure that we are, as a region, working together to try and find those solutions to the infrastructure challenges. Because if we're able to do that, then we are unlocking more land to build these homes. And then, obviously, labor's an issue. We've continued. I think there's a chronic skilled labor shortage in this community that we're trying to overcome. And we kind of danced around it, but a big component of this is trying to grow the economy in a way we're attracting jobs that are paying high wages and increasing that area median household income.
Well, we'll definitely talk about the economic development aspect later with you, because I'm going to get to the point where we talk about what some of the other issues Saba advocates for. Mm-hmm. But let's go to the skilled labor one.
Sure.
Because that's one.
Yeah.
There's a lot of discussion on what industries are short on skilled laborers and what industries could use help, specifically from day workers and others who have those skills, are willing to come over and do it. What's the challenge? Why are there not more people right now that want to do those jobs of building houses, like to work with their hands?
Well, and I would qualify, I know I mentioned skilled, but it's really labor across the board for home building. And Ted, maybe, put your, 20-year-old Ted hat on. You're in 2025, would you want to go work on a roof in Tucson, Arizona in 105 degree heat, right? I think that there's a some of those kind of physical realities in the generation that's current, now coming into the labor market. I just don't know if the trades, across the board are as enticing as they may have once been. But I think the reality is, if you're able to learn that skill, go into the trades, you're going to be, you know, you're going to have a job for a long, long time. You're going to have a skill that's never going to leave you, and you're going to make really good money. And so it's,
I think people miss that opportunity, that there is the ability to make the real good money. And like you said, if you enjoy it, you want to do it, but I guess, you know, everybody can't be an influencer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, but that's, you know, that's a perception. And again, when you're 18, 19, 20 years old, I think that it's hard to look long-term. And that's really what a career in the trades requires, because you are in many people are going through some sort of training program to get that skill that takes time. They're going on the job. They're the low man on the totem pole when they get started. But that's what we've been really trying to not only get people interested in the trades, but then seeing what that continuum is. And so you go from working on a crew to managing a crew, to managing multiple crews, to owning your own company. So I do think that's part of it, is telling that story about the long-term opportunities for success in the trades.
Well, it looks like we might have a little activity on the phone, and I think Matt has a question for you as well. So why don't we jump to a break right now? And when we come back, we'll see what they've got for you. Appreciate you being here.
Absolutely.
David Godlesky, the president and CEO of the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association, and a good friend. So I appreciate you joining me today. Please stay with us. 10:30 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. We will be right back. Welcome back. Yeah, I saw the point, Matt, get going. I just wanted to listen to the music a little bit more.
That, that's okay.
Good song selection. Little Tom Petty. No, I'll never turn that one down. All right. So apparently, building houses has got some attention. So I've got caller Matt is on line two with a quick question. Matt, go ahead. Thank you for calling in and listening to the show today.
Yeah, David, my father was a contractor. So when I grew up, I mean, we spent half of our life under construction or at construction sites. And I, as early as, 14, I was framing houses. And it was fun, summers to put on the belt and do framing work. And I was just curious, at what age are you guys able to engage with TUSD or any other youth regarding future employment in those trades? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Matt, for the question. That's actually really good. What is Saba and what are the builders doing to connect with the next generation?
It's really an ongoing effort, and we try and connect with even elementary school kids. So our national association, the National Association of Home Builders, worked to commission a book a couple of years ago called "The House That She Built," and it's a book geared towards girls who are in elementary school to even plant the seed about the construction as a career. We have been, one of the leaders in terms of working with some of the other construction organizations around the community in hosting the annual Southern Arizona Construction Career Days. And that has been a very, very well-received event. And we are focusing on not just high school, but also middle school students through that. Construction Career Days is actually going through an evolution right now where they are going to be working on trying to get into classrooms specifically. So not just have the one day where kids can come out and get some exposure, kind of directly hands-on to what they would work on in the trades, but making sure that we're also going into the classroom. So yes, you really have to try and plant that seed as early as realistically possible.
Well, there's no doubt the construction career days are incredibly effective. I know at the Air National Guard base up in, it's the Joint Force Headquarters base, not that it matters, up in Phoenix, they've got a huge construction day event once every year, and the number of students that you could expose it to. And the fact of the matter is the percentage of high school students who are going on to college or even secondary education in some respects is shrinking. It is absolutely going down. And to expose them, the amount of income and the revenue you can make in the trades truly is not what people used to think it is. It is a above median, significantly above median wage income.
That's right. And we would even say that, you know, there are many, many jobs within the construction industry that require that that college education. And working in the trades is also another way to pay your way through college. So I just think there are so many benefits with a career in the trade. And it's important to try and communicate that and make that direct connection with those future workers.
And Matt, you got a question for David before we get off the home building?
You know, and I know sort of the answer I may be getting asking somebody who's in the business of building homes, and this is okay, but it seems to me about 15 years ago, we were bombarded with messaging, you know, from the economic summits that they have in Tucson and this and that. The Tucson has a one-dimensional economy, and our economy is too reliant on home building. And here we are 15, you know, years later, 10 plus years later, 20 years later, maybe, talking about how we have a shortage of housing. There's a shortage of affordable housing. You know, David, are we paying the price for maybe misguided economic policy or advice?
Well, I definitely think that if you went back and looked at, you know, kind of the municipal government budgets and the amount of revenue that they were getting in that, you know, 2004, 5, 6, 7 time period to what they were receiving in that, you know, 2008, 9, 10, 11, you would have to, in my opinion, draw a correlation to the amount of money and revenue that was coming in and the amount of economic benefit that was associated with home building. And that fall off in home building associated with the Great Recession was very significant. And so I do think it is important that we value construction jobs of all types, not just home building, but commercial construction as well. And that is a foundational element of our economy. And we've got to be working in the right direction. Yes, absolutely. We need high-tech, high-skilled, high-wage jobs. But we do have to have something that is more than just, you know, than just one-dimensional from an economic perspective.
Wow, thanks a lot. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, that's a good spot on answer, and it's good to know. So we've got about 1 minute.
Okay.
Yep. Perfect opportunity. Can you give me what your suggestion would be to bring that median income down or to address specifically the much lower income affordable housing element that we're missing in the community? What's the biggest thing this region could change?
Well, you know, I look at it, what can you control? You know, it's really difficult to control interest rates. It's really difficult to control material pricing, but we can certainly control the regulatory environment. We can certainly control the policies that we have in place that affect, you know, the cost to develop, the cost to build. And so that's where I would say, I think it's important to do kind of a deep dive in looking at what's really necessary. Are there better, more efficient ways to do things? Are there efficiencies that can be gained? Are there fees that are in place that can be reduced? That's really a priority in my opinion.
Well, I know Saba will always continue advocating in that way and obviously working on things from zoning, permitting,
that's right,
setbacks. There's a lot of ways we could do it. We're just not doing it yet.
Hopefully soon.
Hopefully soon. So you're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. David Godlewski will remain with me. See you after the break. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell, Matt Neely behind the glass. Tomorrow, Grant Kruger will be hosting The Morning Voice on Wednesday for Food for Thought. Grant's been getting a little time away from this heat, but he's back tomorrow with his guest, so I'm sure he's going to come with a lot of energy. Grant can bring a lot of energy to the show, and I think you'll see that tomorrow. So definitely listen in. I know I will be, and we'll see what he has to say. So, David, thanks for the conversation on home building. That's what I appreciate about bringing you in. We know that's your area of expertise, and it's always an area of interest to folks who want to build wealth. And through home ownership is the best way I think any of us can continue to build wealth. But there's so many other things that play into this. Okay, you kind of alluded to it in your conversation about the market, the demand, and all that. One of them is economic development. So you wrote an op-ed in support of Project Blue. And last week, the city voted 7-0 to say it's not coming to us. Now, Project Blue's not dead. There's other areas in this region. What is it that you'd like to see us change in this economic development world? Why is this region not growing?
Well, you know, I think, Ted, you said earlier about Saba being influential, but clearly if you see the council action after that op-ed ran, I don't know if we
Oh, my God, if the home builders are right. so supporting yeah. this, we've got to go
that,
now.
That's right. But, you know, look, I think it's, you know, one of the things that I talk about in with the people that I interact with in members is that if you look at the Metro Phoenix area, right, you know, I'm not sure, you know, even today, if Tucson can claim to be the second largest city in the state.
And, I believe Mesa has passed us number one.
And so, and I think that just goes, not only is you have the first, the second, and how many other right large communities in Maricopa County. And so it's all the more important that here locally we're working together. Everybody's rowing the boat in the same direction, and our success is dependent as a region. It's dependent on the success of each of the individual communities. And so that's where I'd really like to see, you know, this concerted effort to trying to make sure that we're creating an environment that is welcoming, conducive for outside capital investment. And I know that best in terms of home building, right? These are corporations that are operated in, you know, in LA or Miami or Denver or wherever. And if they're looking at making a you know, 30, 40, 50 million dollar plus capital investment, they're going to want to deploy that capital in a place that it's going to be the best received, where they're going to get the best return, and it's going to be welcomed. And so we need to make sure that when it's whether it's data centers, you know, whether it's you know, autonomous vehicles, whatever that might be, we just need to make sure that we're putting our best foot forward. And really, I think the other thing I would say is creating that vision for what that economic future looks like. And then putting the plans, putting the processes, putting the regulations in place, the incentives to make sure that we can do that as a community.
Well, there's no doubt we need some wins, and we need some wins in the city of Tucson. We need some wins in Pima County.
And that's where, you know, I'm not sure we're in a position as a community. We've just not had enough success to be selective, right? And I think we need those wins. We shouldn't compromise by any means. And I do think it's important that we, you know, listen to what people want. But I think we've got to get some wins under our belt. We've got to keep, you know, get some momentum going. And the other thing, it's like, if we just continue to litigate every time, you know, litigate publicly anytime a company wants to come here, you know, I just don't know why you would want to go through that if you're looking to make that type of investment in Tucson. And so I do think there's a public participation process that's critical. Just making sure, though, that and I think that's where that vision and those strategies may help us, so that when we're communicating publicly why we're talking to these employers, that it's clear because it matches what we've said we want as a region.
Well, I fully agree with you at that, and I think the process is what broke down. Really, that's the one outcome from Project Blue that disappoints me the most, is I think the process that ran is not helpful for any company coming here in the future.
No,
we've got to stand up and start saying, you know, I know they get tired of hearing it, but we are open for business. We need to support business, because when it comes to qualifying for a home or your affordability of a house, it's based on median income.
That's right. You know, I have a board member who I was talking to a couple weeks ago. She runs a large home builder here in Southern Arizona, and her mantra, and she was kind of encouraging me and saying, look, it's not no, but how. And I think that's the key thing, is that if we lead with no, it's going to discourage people from coming here. But we should be asking the question, how are we going to make these things work? How are we going to make sure that we're protecting our, you know, our water resources, how we're minimizing the energy burden? You know, that answering the how is really key. But if we just keep saying no, 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 I think it's going to be you know, challenging long term to attract employers.
So this is a big week for the Regional Transportation Authority. There's a technical management committee meeting tomorrow. We've got a board meeting, and full disclosure, I sit on that Regional Transportation Authority board as a byproduct of my appointment by Governor Ducey to the Arizona State Transportation Board. But we've got 3 weeks to get something to go to the county so that we can go to the voters in March, or we risk losing 2/3 of our regional transportation dollars. How important to your industry is regional transportation infrastructure?
Critical. I mean, no question. And Ted, I'm encouraged because, you know, 3 weeks ago, if you would have said, what are your thoughts on the RTA, I would have been very pessimistic about its future to get on the ballot March next year or otherwise. But I've seen the amount of work that's been put in by people like you, like Mike Ortega, like the leaders who are on the different municipalities, whether on the TMC or the regional council. So I think it's important, but we absolutely have to have that transportation network in our community to be able to continue to get people from one place to the next as most efficient and effective as possible, but also using it as that economic development strategy, that home building strategy, that housing strategy. Roads are key.
Well, I appreciate that support. I'm going to encourage Saba as well as other entities to speak up on this issue. The Technical Management Committee has met 4 times in the last 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They almost all were joking about needing to have, you know, cots down at the PEG. So they are doing the yeoman's work. It will be up to the board to finalize what moves forward. So any encouragement that you could be, because to me, roads are part of infrastructure, and the infrastructure is the backbone of a community for economic development growth and for quality of life. I think sometimes we forget that.
Absolutely. I'm there. You know, I think we need that 20-year plan with the 20 years worth of funding behind it. That's what the voters authorized in 2006. And I think that's what we as a community need to bring back to them in 2026. And so you've got our support with that.
So that's the voice of David Godlewski. I appreciate you taking the time to come with me. I appreciate all you do for Saba, but more importantly, I appreciate what you do for the region and the state. A lot of people don't know, but you're very involved in the water world as well. So I'm definitely going to want to get you back probably in the next couple of months, because there's a lot going on in the water world
right now.
So thank you for your time today, David. Look forward to having you back, and keep up all the good work.
Thanks, Ted.
All right, Matt. That's the voice of David Godlewski, the president and CEO of the Southern Arizona Home Builders Association. You're listening to 1030 The Voice, trusted local news and talk. And when we come back, you'll have a little bit more of Ted and Matt discussing all things going on in the region. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Voice. I'm your host, Ted Maxwell. Matt Neely's behind the glass, and you're going to hear a little bit more from him shortly. Matt, I always love having David Godlewski on. He's got so much knowledge on so many different areas, and he's been working at Saba for so many years. He can talk about almost anything.
Yep. And again, just so many interrelated things to the home building, to the price of goods and services, to the labor pool, and to being able to welcome people to Tucson with a place to live, the region. So yeah, there's a lot going on there.
It's kind of ironic with the RTA. One of the reasons that the funds fell short on collections. Yes, 2008 occurred, but it wasn't even so much that. It was the fact that we dropped on a growth chart.
What was the assumption in the original RTA? What was the population for the region?
Just about 1.4 billion plus or minus.
Million.
Million. Yeah,
sorry,
million.
And
what do we have?
About 1.1, is that what you said?
Yeah,
we're just kind of been hovering around that 1 million.
And the 1.1, we've gone up and down. I mean, it's been a pretty straight trend line. And the good thing is RTA Next is planned on that slow trend line. But man, this area was rocking until about 2005, and then it just went tipped over. Now, that was a precipice from 2008, but we never pulled out of it. And we've got to figure out how to get people to move here. That doesn't mean we're going to lose the nature of what Pima County and Tucson is. We've proven that. We've got property, we've got land, we've got ability to grow, mm-hmm. but we need to bring jobs, because that's going to drive our tax base and our revenues. Mm-hmm. And in the city of Tucson, in Pima County, they're finding that the tax base needs to grow. It's not grow the rate. Yeah. Let's not grow the rate. Let's grow the pie.
Right.
You've got to bring people here. But as we talked about, a lot's happened since last Tuesday.
Universities and mines, this is what happens.
Right. And a lot's happened since last Tuesday. We talked about the election results, but then the next day, 7-0 vote from the council saying no to Project Blue.
Yeah.
I understand. The public spoke really loud. They put the process that the city decided to run in order to get the information out, put them either intentionally or unintentionally in a real hard position, because those public meetings were terrible.
Right.
It actually led to a series of, at the council meeting, Mayor Romero was pretty clear on calling out her disappointment in the county for letting it get this far, and her disappointment in the staff, the economic development arm of the city, for letting it get this far and participating, because Project Blue's been in the works for 2-3 years. I mean, a lot of people look at SALC and say, why didn't you know? Well, we're not in the economic development field. We're in the policy position. Mm-hmm. So I've never been read in on any of these NDAs. No idea. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden there was finger pointing, and that was a response in the Tucson Sentinel. Supervisor Scott, who's the chair of the Board of Supervisors, wrote one directly responding back to the city saying, don't be pointing mm-hmm. this at us. You've known about this as well.
Well, and when they come in and dangle, hey, here's $9 million of tax revenue annually for X number of years, maybe that clouded their judgment in wanting to kind of fast track this thing through, which is exactly what they did. This thing was made public a few months ago, in terms of any sort of details that anybody could latch onto. You had people at those public meetings. They brought up towards the end of the big one on that Monday night a week ago, they brought up the people in there, and there was a large positive response from the crowd. They wanted this thing to go to a direct election. They want the populace of Tucson to vote on people, on entities coming to town.
But we have elections to elect representatives.
Right.
And it's the job of the representatives to make the decision. I'm all for public engagement. I was very disappointed in the two public meetings.
Right.
And I think that's what Supervisor Scott
went out. They devolved into shouting matches.
Well, we were told the business community didn't show up. My question is, really? You're asking anybody to show up and be yelled at, to be cussed at in some situations. I mentioned it last week on there. One of my employees, or one of the folks that was on our team at SALC, was hit in the head with a protest sign by a lady who came up and said, what are you doing here? You look like you're part of the business community, so you must be in favor of that. And the next thing boom, she takes the sign, and Chief Kasmar even said, yeah, that'd be assault. But he just walked away. I mean, that's
wow.
But why? Somebody said the business community didn't show up. If you had taken 500 seats, then there'd only be 500 people. My point would have been, you still would have had 500 people yelling at the speakers, yelling them down. 500, 800, Mox-Nicks. There was no what I called decorum and professionalism at those two meetings. And I went on a First Amendment rant, what it is and what isn't, last time. They have the right to say, stop. You will be asked to leave if you don't let the speakers we've asked to speak so people can hear them. I had members that were there to support or to learn more about Project Blue, and they, Chris Edwards, who's he was on this show, one of the sponsors of this show, he said, Ted, I couldn't hear anything because there was so much noise and yelling around me. So from being an informational meeting, those didn't work. They actually created problems.
Yeah. And one of the things that, one of the elements that I saw, I saw one guy with a no cap end capitalism shirt. So water and electricity are valid concerns. They Amen. Are worthy of examination, of study, of good, honest discussion. But boy, when you throw in with the end capitalism folks, when you throw in with the communists, it sort of makes me feel like some of those, it takes away from the validity of two very valid arguments, the water and power argument.
Well, and the water and power argument, to your point, of feeling like it was thrown on us and it was rushed. Mm-hmm. Now, my understanding, and again, I'm not in the economic development field, but my understanding is both the county and the city have been part of working on this for several years.
Sure.
And there were members of the elected councils, maybe not all of them, that also were informed of what was coming on, working on it. And then all of a sudden, it seemed rushed. Okay, we got to get the vote, got to move, got to make this happen. So you're going to get people saying, stop. Water, absolutely valid concern. Mm-hmm. It is a resource here.
Yeah.
And it's important.
And I think that, there was talk about misreading the room or really not knowing where you live. You didn't think this was going to be a big issue once it made public. Oh, yeah. I mean, if they could have come forward and said, look, we're going to do a warp speed project on this 18-mile pipeline, and the toilet to tap water is going to go to the data center before it goes to a house. I think you could have showed that you're being innovative, and you're saying, we know this is a controversial element of it, but You know, this is how we're going to mitigate. It's going to get served to their cooling towers. The other thing is, I don't know if it's true or not, but this Vermaland company, who you see on the trailers along I-10 between Phoenix and Blythe, they're saying they can do one with just a cooling tower with recirculating water and heat exchangers. Right?
Correct. This, I mean, in the data center.
So where's the innovation?
In the data center community, it is all about innovation right now. People are basing things on a prior generation of data centers. And I'm not saying data centers are the catch-all, end-all, but what I'm telling you is everybody that was at that meeting yelling all had cell phones. All had access to the cloud.
They probably went to ChatGPT and said, give me a good argument to use at the meeting tonight.
Which runs through these data centers. That is just how it is. So it's... I was disappointed in that. We need to have these conversations. My belief is you're going to see a couple data centers come to this region. And if you want to control them, you know, Nikki Lee kind of brought it up before the vote, and she voted no as well. Mm-hmm. I think they boxed themselves into a corner that they had no choice. But the worst part of it to me was, if I was a town manager for any town competing against the city of Tucson, I'd just send the company a video of the Monday show. I'd send them a video of the city council vote and the people, how disrespectful it was. It wasn't a good image for us. It was not a good image.
Right.
All right.
Well, Matt, great show today.
As always, appreciate it. Thank you for joining us today. The Morning Voice on 10:30 a.m., your trusted local news and talk station. Have a great week, everybody.
Win Tucson coming up next.